All right, big news, big win for the international proletariat. Today, you thought last week was V-Day, but this week, today is going to be the new V-Day because Musk is stepping down. The terror is over. The hands-off movement and the Democratic Party of Wisconsin have surrounded the Doge Fuhrer bunker, and Musk has finally imitated Hitler's other famous gesture of shooting himself in the head and his little dog. And now we are liberated from the tyranny of Musk, because everything's going to be fine.
Well, we'll see about that.
We're here to celebrate with David Morris, one of my favorite writers on tech and futurism and the immense idiocy of all of it. You can check out his Substack in the show notes. And he's got a book coming up on scam bankman Freud fraud.
Freud is actually not bad either. It's a lot of that.
That was a Freudian slip. Maybe he looks like a member of my family, but yeah, SBF and the Tech Utopians, that's the name of the book.
It's still sort of in flux, but the full title is Stealing the Future, Sam Bankman-Fried, Elite Fraud, and the Cult of Techno-Utopia. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the Musk connection is definitely in there too. It's a book that I was really afraid was going to be obsolete by the time it came out 2 years after his criminal trial, but turns out the connections, he was a preview of what was coming,
yeah.
I think. And it's still new things are happening all the time that relate to it in ways that are obviously very scary.
Yeah, we can get rid of him, we can get rid of Musk, but you know, we're still living in their world, I think it's safe to say.
Yeah, and I mean, I obviously, some of that intro was a little jokey, and I can already tell I'm going to be in the position of the journalist who, for some of the jokes, I just have to kind of smile and nod along and not comment.
Oh, that's disappointing, because your Substack is very funny.
Maybe my period of training in the traditional media world will overtake me, but Musk is, you know, it's, you can never tell with these people what they say versus what they're actually going to do. But in theory, he is taking a step back from Doge because his company is dying, which is, you know, hilarious and also kind of continuous with the stuff that I write about on the Substack and in the book, having to do with, you know, tech valuations being completely out of control and inflated and crazy, and based on these like sort of mostly fictional visions of the future. And Musk, I think, really figured that out maybe before anybody else, because he's been promising self-driving cars since like 2013 or something ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, other people actually figured it out before him, which is excellent and hilarious. Tesla had this like catastrophic earnings report. The most recent quarter, they were down, their revenues are down 70% year over year, which, you know, happens when you're a Nazi selling cars and people don't like that. But he's, you know, sort of trying to go back and correct that, and I don't think it'll happen. But in the meantime, he has all of these, you know, peasant defenders circling his walls, ready to sacrifice their bodies for Tesla's market cap. It's ridiculous and it's sad and really scary. And that's kind of where we are now, is that even though, you know, people like us kind of see through all that bullshit, there is a huge cohort of people who have now basically 100% adopted the idea that if you're rich, you're king. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the world we live in.
Yeah, but I don't even know if you can call it an idea. It's just kind of like, well, this person's super rich, he has a lot of power, and therefore we kind of have to... It's just like people siding with power. It's not so much an idea. I don't know. It's just
absolutely. And that's why, you know, that's where the Freud comes in, right? Which is that, like...
That was my plan all along.
Yeah. That, you know, it's like, it's not an articulated idea. It's just this feeling that people have because they want these heroes who, you know, essentially, like, you know, being an Elon Musk defender on X.com, the everything app, is telling yourself that everything is going to be okay because Elon is going to take care of you. And like, you know, literally we found out recently he's like catering, or he sort of boosts women in particular who he wants to like get active on the app so that he can hit the DMs and get them to have his baby. And you know, everybody is living out some version of that dream of like, maybe Elon is going to somehow make me a tiny fraction of as rich as he is if
maybe
I'm nice to him on
me.
His own website.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, impregnate me with money. That's yeah, the, right. yeah.
I gotta say, I've been, I haven't been a fan for as long as Andy, but I've read your work over the last couple of days, and it is really good and really funny. And I don't know how you don't go crazy from all this shit. Like, I read about effective altruism, and then there's an effective accelerationism, and then there's the Zizians, which Andy has introduced me to.
We'll get into the Zizians, yeah.
There's all this shit, and I don't know how you do this without losing your fucking mind, because, like, you appear to be about my age, which leads me to believe that you have some superpower where you're able to, like, not lose your fucking mind listening to and reading these psychopaths every day. How do you do it, David?
Well, first of all, I'm going to speculate and say I might secretly be a lot older than you, but I do think that part of it is that I've seen a lot of this before, and that even goes to, you know, I don't mean to be like a nihilist or cynical, but that even goes to like Donald Trump. You know, like Donald Trump is giving people in their, you know, 20s and 30s nightmares, but I'm just like, he's not even half as scary as George W. Bush was 20 years ago. And I don't mean to say that, like, that doesn't mean he's not bad, or that means he's not bad. He's awful, and he represents this much longer trend in American life. And I think that's kind of how I deal with all of this, is that everything is just, you know, repetition. Everything has already happened. So, you know, we talk about like the effective altruists. You know, they have, whether they know it or not, they're rooted in a lot of the, you know, group therapy stuff that happened in California going all the way back to the 60s with like Esalen and Est.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
I mean, they have very similar approaches and very similar mindsets in terms of, above all, thinking that the brain is a form of technology that you can kind of upgrade in this very like engineering based way. And also, you know, they're very linked to Scientology conceptually, because the same way that Scientology talks about like going clear and getting rid of, I forget the term in Scientology, but it's like
body thetans.
Thetans, yes, yeah. Thetans. So,
Let's go around. What's our thetan levels? I'm clear.
I am clear in the sense that I don't care. Me and my thetans have learned
Sounds
to get along.
Sounds like you got some thetans, buddy.
Yeah,
I care. I care a lot. I signed the billion-year contract. You know, and I'm still trying to get out from under all these body thetans. I'm working on it. I'm working the steps.
Oh, it's like a billion-year contract. That's good.
Yeah, billion years.
Okay, wait, you might have actually identified something that I'm not familiar with. That's another common thread. What is the billion-year contract?
Oh, when you sign up for Scientology, you basically sign on a billion-year contract to work with them, to be part of the Sea Org, or I guess when you die in Scientology, you become...
Yeah, they believe in reincarnation. Yeah.
Right.
And
right.
Yeah, so like your next life will also be... You'll be a Scientologist.
So again, this is like absolutely in line with the way that the EAs and rationalists think, because it's all... It's A, long-termist, and B, long-termist in the sense of like they're trying to predict what's going to happen 10,000 years in the future of the human race, and like using sort of pseudo math to do that. And then the other thing that is, you know, a part of the entire ideology is the desire to prevent the extinction of the human race, to make sure that humanity itself lasts forever. So again, it's like very Freudian. It's this fear of death that runs through all of it. And it's actually amazing. You know, Elon Musk, obviously, his connections go back to Peter Thiel, who's very tied up. He sponsored J.D. Vance. He, you know, he tried. Blake Masters was J.D. Vance 1.0, and he turned out to be too weird. And Peter Thiel, there's this amazing story. When he was like 3 years old, there was a like lion skin or cat skin rug of some sort in his house, which tells you a lot about the house in the first place. But he talked to his father, and his father was like, yes, that animal died. I will die someday. You will die. And, you know, this is a conversation that all kids have at some point. Peter Thiel is so traumatized by this at 3 years old that it has haunted him for his entire life. And this is like he, you know, has these blood boys reputedly, and does all this weird stuff to try and extend his life. And there's versions of this story told by like Ray Kurzweil, who's one of the Singularity guys. his father died young. Eliza Yudkowsky, the head of the rationalist movement, had a brother who died at 19, very tragically. And these are like, obviously they are real, wrenching, tragic experiences, but this cadre of people have interpreted it all through this belief that technology will save us from everything, and therefore we must advance technology to, in some sense, defeat death. Mm. So rather than having the sort of human or humanity's response of like, this is a story that I'm a part of, this is a continuum that is the human race, it's like, no, we have to stop death. We have to stop the cycle and kind of live in, well, partly we have to upload our brains to computers so that we can live together.
Yeah, you know, the
forever.
Do you know about the Biocosmist Immortalists? It was a Bolshevik faction.
Absolutely. This is cosmism again, repetition. This is going all the way back to what, like the 1920s.
Yeah, and there is a good book by actually a very anti-communist author named John Gray about the Biocosmist Immortalists called the Immortality Commission, I think. And he was basically making the argument, you know, even though these were communists and even though we can like read it as being socialist utopian in some ways, their real vision was the destruction of humanity. It was eugenic. It was justifying mass murder, you know, during and after the Civil War. And, you know, the immortalist thing kind of dies out like with Stalinism. But it is interesting to see the through lines there, especially in terms of, you know, what the rationalists are religiously convinced will happen. Yeah. And, you know, some of them maybe don't want it to happen, but because it will happen no matter what, they're just preparing for it. So that's where the Zizians come in. But maybe. So I want to transition and talk more about Yudkowsky and the Zizians and SBF, of course. So we have a lot of ground to cover. But before we do that, I'm just wondering if you have a sense that with Musk's fall from Doge, the sort of problems that Tesla is having, which you've written quite a lot about, do you think like his kind of unique position or vision within Silicon Valley? Has he lost some stature there?
I think he's in a very fragile position, and I mean that in two senses, which is literally financially, he's extremely leveraged. And the crazy thing that happened after this bad earnings report was that the Tesla stock went up because, I mean, basically, as far as I can tell, because he like talked about putting humanoid robots in his factories, which is these ideas that he has, he's selling them to stupid people who become his investors and his backers and are pumping his stock. And stupid people only have so much money. And so there is a stop limit to what he's doing right now. And I mean, Twitter is not making money. He owes the Saudis like $10 billion or whatever. So financially, he's in a very fragile position. Obviously, he's doing a ton of drugs. But I think that like, the entire thing that he's tied himself to, and this is a situation more broadly in the Silicon Valley world and especially in, you know, my branch of it in kind of cryptocurrency, where like people bet on Trump and it is turning out to have been a really bad bet, like exceptionally bad in terms of, you know, all of these tariffs. Part of the reason that that Musk is crashing out of Doge is because there was this conflict with Peter Navarro, the trade secretary, about the tariffs, because obviously like Tesla manufactures things in the United States, it needs to get parts, it's kind of at risk of getting fucked by some of these things, and so there is that like practical level, and then the sort of reputational level I think is harder to judge, because I think we're still in the kind of like the coyote just ran off the cliff and hasn't really noticed that there's nothing under its feet yet. In terms of Trump and Trumpism, I think that there has been a big sort of cold splash of water of awareness among certain people that, like, this is not the guy we thought we were supporting. Again, specifically on the tariff thing, like the sort of neoliberal right, which I think is how you would define a lot of the Silicon Valley support at this point, they have really, I think, increasingly realized that they bet on the wrong horse. Although I will say, I'm on a bit of a thing here, but like the other thing about Trump that I think we're being reminded of is that he does do these insane things and then like totally pulls them back. So for example, the tariffs, he's basically like canceled all of them. And I think not quite, but like pulled them way back.
Do you mean just for Silicon Valley, for like electronics and stuff?
I mean, it's all fucked up. Like even the individual deals, like they don't make any sense. It's like he's cutting these deals that are actually going to hurt American manufacturing. Yeah, he doesn't know what he's doing. And
if you 10-15 years ago said that across the board you'd have 10% tariffs on everything, that the United States would put up these trade barriers, it would seem insane. So, like, we've backed off from the 100-something% that he was proposing on allies or whatever, that crazy spreadsheet that apparently was maybe made by AI. That's all been pulled back. But still, 10% tariffs on basically all goods entering the United States is like a sea change in American economic policy.
Yeah, we used to be able to have 30 sex dolls. Now we can only have three beautiful sex dolls.
Yeah.
And they'll be better. They'll be made in America.
They'll be like those cool sex robots that are being produced now in Silicon Valley. Instead of having like cheap blow-up dolls, the American worker, you know, after they've got their great $20 an hour factory job in the mines working next to like anthropoid robots or whatever, they'll have good sex dolls. That's what Trump is promising. And I, you know,
it's not the kind that becomes self-aware and kills you.
Who can say what's really self-aware at this point, which is actually, like, you mentioned the AI spreadsheet, and of course all of this plugs into AI too, and it's this, like, you know, naive view of the computer as brain and friend, that it, when we get into Yudkowsky and SBF, that's obviously a lot of the source of some of this stuff. But to finish the point about Musk, I think that, like, his problem is different from the problem of the rest of Silicon Valley because he is just losing his mind. He didn't make like a single bad political decision. He's like falling apart as a human being. And I do think that even though he's technically the richest man in the world or like very close to it, I think that, well, I guess I have to say that that does have a kind of inevitable gravity, but the combination of his, I think, looming financial problems and this just like having become, and you know, I've been writing about Musk since like 2015. So I've watched this frankly terrible decline in him as a human being, not to say that he wasn't always a dark figure, but he kept it a lot more under wraps. And I think that those two things coming together, it's going to be a reckoning for him. I hope, I guess I'd say I hope.
I feel like we haven't seen the last of him. But yeah, maybe we can start talking about SBF, or should we start with Yudkowsky?
Well, so I guess we can like gently transition because of the, you know, the AI tariffs are just one symptom of this huge other catastrophe coming along in the information ecosystem as AI becomes this kind of like, you know, people are actually listening when people like Sam Altman say that like the AI is self-aware or like it's going to solve cancer or solve climate change. These are all things that the AI companies believe that it's going to just like rocket research forward into the future and humans aren't going to have to actually think about anything anymore. And that is what's interesting about that is that, so Eliezer Yudkowsky starting in like 2003, really, he is this kind of, in his way, brilliant guy who got very worried about AI, but he did not get worried at all about the actual informational implications of these AIs and what would happen since they're all trained on the archive of human communication. They're going to show the same, you know, biases and distortions and, you know, oh, they're also like, because of the specific way this LLM technology works, they're going to hallucinate. Like, none of that is on the agenda for Yudkowsky, whether at the beginning or even going forward. He founds this thing called the Machine Intelligence Research Institute because he's afraid that Skynet is going to become real and annihilate us all, like Terminator style. Mm-hmm. Or like the very slightly different version of it is that if you have an AI that is given the instruction to like maximize any one thing, it won't have any particular concern for human well-being. And then it will, in the sort of illustration that is often given, if you order an AI to produce paperclips, it'll turn everything into paperclips, including human beings. So, you know, at the root of it, this is the rationalist movement, right? So he thinks, he has this idea that AI is going to destroy everything. Then he realizes that nobody agrees with him. And his conclusion is that they're thinking wrong. And so in addition to the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, I need to start this other thing or get my friends to start this other thing called the Center for Applied Rationality, where he starts to like spread the gospel that you need to think more rationally. But ultimately, the point of all of this is that you need to think more rationally so that you agree with me about the AI coming to kill us all.
Yeah, don't read Kant. Listen to Yudkowsky. So is this the same circle that found the, what's it called, MIRI in Stanford? And this is their sort of like AI apocalypse think tank that the Zizians come out of.
Yes, and they're very... So MIRI and CIFAR are kind of sister organizations. So rationalism and the AI alignment research are very closely related. And also related to effective altruism. Basically, over time, those movements all became very closely aligned. So we can talk about the Zizians a little bit. This is a group of people sort of nebulously sort of spread across the United States, but a lot of it happened in the Bay Area naturally, because that's where they kind of went to go and study with Yudkowsky essentially. And one of the big, the overlaps between effective altruism, which was, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried later became a big backer of effective altruism, because the core message of effective altruism and rationalism circa like 2014 was this thing called earn to give, which is where if you as a person have this like desire to make the world a better place, and you also have even the slightest shred of like financial or technical skill, you should actually not try and make the world a better place. You should go and work on Wall Street or do a tech startup and then donate money to good causes. And this reflects the kind of like A, financialized, and B, very sort of like engineering brained version of doing good that these people advocate, which is effectively like you have to maximize everything. You have to totally trust scientific experiments to tell you which direction development economics can be guided by philanthropic efforts. So it's a lot of kind of naive scientism towards social issues. Like we're going to do a survey of people in Western Africa, and based on that survey results, we're going to just like dump billions of dollars into one nonprofit that takes the approach that we like sort of interpret that as saying is correct. It's very like data centric, not a lot of interpretive nuance or even like on the ground experience in terms of how they implement these programs. And so Ziz was one of the people who around 2014, according to their own claims, talked to somebody named Anna Solomon, who was one of the leaders of the rationalist movement at the time. And Anna Solomon was like, you know, I know you care a lot about veganism, but instead you should go to grad school and do it, and then go for 1 year, drop out when you find somebody you can do a startup with. So dropping out is another huge one. So
the veganism was before the Zizian cult thing. Because I thought the veganism came out of that. I'm a vegan myself, so I was very interested in this aspect of the story.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, well, there's a lot to say about that in general, but my understanding is that, you know, Ziz was a very committed vegan and attracted others around them, but kind of part of the conflict with the mainline rationalist community was that they were not vegan enough, or not vegan at all, really. That became more of an effective altruist thing, which we can get into, but the way that this hit Ziz was they were like, everybody who's working on AI safety must be a vegan, because otherwise the AI will absorb their behavior and then later treat human beings the way that we treat animals.
And this is actually, you know, when veganism was kind of like a big thing in the anarcho-punk scene in the aughts, maybe Sean can help me out here a little bit if you remember it this way, yeah. Too. That was kind of, it was like that logic, but from like a leftist humanist perspective. Uh-huh. That's like animal liberation is human liberation.
Right, right.
Because if we, you know, if we have these horrific factory farms, like if this is how we produce meat and like this very cruel slaughter of animals, that's just going to transfer to the way we treat surplus population, essentially.
Right, right.
Which
right.
I think is true.
Absolutely.
But then this kind of the like rationalist spin on it is it's not even about the animals anymore. It's about convincing the machines to treat us like you would treat like a free range chicken
or
something.
Right, 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 right. Yeah.
And even, you know, beyond that, what's fascinating is that the way rationalists and EAs, they're both fundamentally utilitarians. And so when you start talking about whether it's animal suffering or human suffering, they literally do this thing where they pretend to be like measuring the amount of suffering in. So they use terms like quality adjusted life years as a way of doing math about the impact of their efforts, which, you know, makes sense on a certain level, but it's part of this greater complex of turning everything into numbers, everything to math, everything to finance in a way where, you know, you said humanistic perspective. There is no humanistic perspective here whatsoever. And on the vegan question,
it's not rational.
Right, exactly. I mean, and very specifically, EAs are like, you should have zero empathy for anybody. There's actually a case, yes. a really good example that comes up. This guy, Will McCaskill, Oxford philosopher, quote unquote, fucking hack. But he makes this case early in one of the books that's the foundation of this movement. He's like, sure, if your uncle dies of cancer, you might feel like you want to give to a cancer research charity. But actually what you're doing there is letting your emotions distort your thinking, because that might not be the most effective way to like help everybody. And it's this kind of like mathematical universalism that boils down to, ultimately, you don't actually care about anything. And so that's the kind of like the soul sucking nature of this. And it relates to veganism in the specific case of SBF, because, you know, he maybe, I don't know Ziz's thought process, and we'll circle back around to this, but Sam Bankman-Fried basically just kind of did the math and was like, I don't want animals to suffer, so I'm going to be a vegan. But it's not because I care about animals. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that he doesn't give a shit about animals on any kind of like emotional or like experiential level. It's just this abstract notion to him. And I think that that's kind of a common thread amongst this entire movement, is people who don't have really strong ethical intuitions and maybe have some kind of like abstract desire to do good. And all of these ideologies are kind of like ways to do math about ethics that are convincing to engineers who have some degree of, frankly, like, I mean, I don't want to say autism full stop, because Sam Bankman-Fried is the opposite of an autist, and we can get into that.
Whoa.
I think for a lot of people, there's some degree of like, I mean, well, that's a specific third rail, so to speak, because some of these people, let's just say, they're kind of into trains in the bad way, and we can get to that too, but yeah, like, they're not people who have really easy connections with other human beings, and that becomes a foundation for how they think about ethics.
When you said trains, were you talking about the polycule in the Caribbean? Is that what you were referring to?
I thought maybe you were talking about like death trains, like
yeah, there's some eugenics ties here that are actually pretty damn shocking, considering how many Jewish people are in prominent positions in the movement. A lot of money from FTX actually went to what ultimately wound up being hosts of eugenic speakers. So people who were writers for VDare, Richard Hanania spoke
at an event. This is the human biodiversity movement?
I mean, literally, essentially, like, Carolyn Ellison, who was the CEO of Alameda Research, has written approvingly about literally HBD and talking about how, like, she loves to think about different subcasts of Indians. And you know, these are, again, like, Bankman-Fried, obviously, if you can't tell, ethnically Jewish, non-religious, Yudkowsky, Jewish, non-religious. And
Yarvin as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, fuck. So, and yet these people are, you know, playing host and promoting, yeah, like Nazism, basically. Mm-hmm. I think in many cases, unknowingly, or it's just kind of an alignment with this pattern of their thought that is very, you know, I mean, the sort of dumb woke version of it is that mathematics is fascist, but like, it's kind of true in this case.
I'm that woke.
Yeah.
And I did not do well at math at school.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm a little bit better at math. I think of myself as a bit of a translator there. So anyway, yeah, there's a eugenics component to this that is very strong.
Yeah.
I hate these people. I really do. I think Nick Land was like a canary in the coal mine. I think that accelerationism going all the way back to, what was the CCRU? That shit. I mean, these people are like recreating Hitlerism from like first principles. And the Judaism thing, I think, is a red herring. Just like we're seeing a genocide persecuted by nominally Jewish people in Israel.
And
right
they're
now.
Robots, too.
Yeah. I mean, this is... I hate to say it, but like the Pope, we need like a stronger Pope. We need a Pope that like
war has, Pope.
We need a war. We need to give the Pope a Gundam. You know what I mean? And he needs to go to Silicon Valley or Financial District or wherever it is and like destroy these people for humanism. That's my take. I don't know.
New crusade.
I mean, I Butlerian jihad, my friend.
yes. Serious. Butlerian Pope.
Yeah, exactly. But I will say, we got. Oh, speaking of which, the Orange Catholic Bible. But I will say, I do have to come to a modest defense of CCRU, because I think that, like, you know, that was obviously a much more complicated moment than just what Nick Land has become. And actually, I'll do a little plug, because my book is coming out on Repeater, which is an outlet founded by Mark Fisher, who was kind of the good part of the CCRU back in the day, and obviously then went on to, I'm sure you guys know his work well, and you know, it's a mind blower to me that I got invited to do this and be a part of that, and I think that the CCRU, you know, it's I consider that moment, and I'm not exactly well versed, but it seems like it was more of an artistic moment than a theoretical moment, but I do think that one really strong connection there was that, you know, as Nick Land started doing more and more amphetamines, he fucking lost it. And that's pretty much also what happened at FTX. Like, those guys were popping addies like crazy. They had a essentially unlicensed therapist there who was just writing scripts for anybody who wanted it. So that I think is another interesting common thread with all these people, and also, of course, the original Nazis.
I was going to say, you know who else was really into amphetamines? The Nazis. But you've tied it all together for me.
Yeah, sorry. Jumped on your step. But, so you start to just see, even in the, like, nuances of how these people live their lives, that, I mean, it's literally accelerationist, right? And a big part of why the amphetamines were in the picture is because there's this sense... And you see this with Doge and Musk. There's this sense of, and this is kind of a big overriding theme of my book, is everything is an emergency, because they have this, literally in the case of Yudkowsky, he lays out essentially like, we're going to treat the universe as, the physical universe as mathematically predictable. So we are going to act as if, maybe to within a degree of error, we can predict the future. And once you believe that you can predict the future, you start thinking about how your individual acts in the present are going to then sort of, not even butterfly effect, but like in a very supposedly predictable way, lead to consequences down the road. And that makes you, and we see it, you know, there are tons of stories, people are experiencing like psychotic breaks. And Ziz is just the most extreme example of this, because once you're kind of weighing every single one of your present actions in terms of billions of people who might theoretically live in the future, it becomes this like unbearable weight and this sense of like panic. And, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried told his psychiatrist that I don't care what happens to my body, because I only have 5 years to make an impact, which he was like 27 at the time that he said this, which is just like it's a mental illness that is instilled by thinking about the world in this mechanistic engineering way where everything is about to happen very fast. The AI is coming immediately, and it's going to destroy us. So we all have to fucking freak out, take speed, make a ton of money on crypto as fast as possible, steal the customer's money, so that we can fund the AI fighting nonprofit that will then like figure out how to make AI that agrees with all human values, which they conceive of as one thing, by the way. So it's just this like very complex thought, like mobile. It's like a I don't know, a spider's web of craziness.
You have to respect it in a sense, because they did make billions off of this absolute batshit idea. And I think the rational kernel of rationalism, which is, you know, not rational, is that the future does look extremely bleak. We know right. things are going to change very dramatically, and someone's got to do something about it.
Yes, and that's, you know, that's why I do credit these people, I think, with having good motivations, because, you know, a lot of the people who gravitated to rationalism and EA were like, and are, I mean, I think that the movements are really in a bad position right now, but I'm sure they still have their adherents, and it's mostly people who are in their, you know, 20s and 30s, people who are former religious types and have kind of lost some faith a little bit. But still want that like world changing opportunity, and they see the darkness and they're emotionally experiencing it, but then they get diverted into this particular way of thinking about it that, you know, I think is quite unproductive and damaging.
You know, back in the 19th century, if you lost your faith and you were looking for some sort of eschaton, you could just go for Marxism. You know what I mean? Like, that's what so many of us have done, right? Is it's replaced our faith in God with our faith in history. And yet, there's something deeply material about this movement, and yet it's like caught in this crazy ideological prison that it's set for itself, where like mathematics, instead of materialism, it's like this weird, as you said earlier, scientism, that like things are ultimately revealable in like a materialist way, but a very ideological way at the same time. So go ahead.
You know, that's where you have to turn it back on itself and do the material analysis of the movement, which is, you know, one of the reasons for this sense of panic amongst these people about AI is because if you tell, it's a double-edged sword. Yudkowsky fears AI, but at the same time, his fear is rooted in this idea that it's all powerful. So the entire like AI doom setup is sort of clandestinely promotion for AI technology. And in fact, that has turned out to materially be real. So OpenAI and Anthropic both actually came more or less out of the rationalist AI safety movement. So they really wound up creating the monster that they were afraid of in a very real way. And at the same time, they have got into this loop of just overpromising habitually, both in terms of timelines and in terms of what the technology is capable of, because that gets them more funding. So they get more venture capital when they make promises that AI is, that AGI in particular, the God AI, the artificial general intelligence that has like consciousness and can like do all human jobs, they have to promise that that's coming soon so that they can get venture capital funding today. And so it becomes about this like acceleration of the rhetoric as much as any real acceleration of the actual technology.
And, you know, one thing that I really love about your writing is that you are very firmly skeptical of all this shit. You're just constantly saying, this is what they believe. It's not true, which is refreshing because a lot of writing has to be like, well, who knows how powerful AI will become, you know? Maybe there's something to this, or like maybe, you know, we even had an episode with Garrison Lovely talking about effective altruism from like a left perspective, and, you know, we disagreed, but, you know, he made some compelling arguments, but your writing is pretty unsparing about what you think about this stuff. But
which, by the way, I am able to do because I am independent and don't work for anybody. So davidzmorris.substack.com, yes. Please subscribe. And yes, if you want to support, please do that.
But I'm wondering if like the danger isn't the AI becoming self-aware and creating the singularity just sort of like out of its own brain, but that people who believe in AI, like religiously, absolutely, like they do, will just talk to it as if it is intelligent, as people do all the time now. You know, I saw this horrifying thread about how AIs respond to someone who's schizophrenic, just validating everything. And so do you think that's the real danger? Yeah. Is that like not Skynet will become aware, but like
we will
ChatGPT
believe in
will
Skynet.
Like tell us to do Skynet and we will.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's incredible to me. I mean, I'm, you know, the process of getting older is just like progressively realizing that people are stupider than you thought, and then realizing again that they're stupider than you thought even the previous time. And like, it is complicated and it is nuanced, but it is also undeniable that the way this technology works is 0% related to the way that they're talking about what it does. I mean, the language is so tricky, right? So even when people say something seemingly subtle, like the AI understands, quote unquote, right? There is no understanding going on there. One of the most unbelievable things in the course of my coverage of this, about 2 years ago, so even before ChatGPT really blew up, there was a Stanford, and by the way, Stanford, my God, there was a Stanford, I think a psychology professor actually, who wrote a paper that basically was like, I talked to the GPT and it responded like a human, so it must have a theory of mind. So theory of mind is where you know, higher animals have a theory of mind where they understand that the creature they're interacting with has its own desires and its own consciousness, basically. And theory of mind is kind of a step towards claiming that the LLM has consciousness, which is the ultimate fucking lie. And they're trying to say that these machines have souls, and that's where you just like have to, that's where we need the battle pope, really. But it's all in pursuit not of any like spiritual meaning. It's in pursuit of convincing people that they should interact with it as if it's alive. It's like what I often think of in cases like this. I don't know if you guys ever had this disease, but I used to play a lot of World of Warcraft in my like 20s, and then recently during the pandemic fell back into it. World of Warcraft is this world, right, where you're having experiences and things are happening, but you know, it's digital, it's simplified. And so if you get too into it, you experience this like deep hollowness where you're like, oh, I just spent my entire day kind of faking having a life. Mm-hmm. And I think that that increasingly is a threat that is going to face people who are getting way too engaged with AI, because whether it's like an AI image or a conversation, it's like you in your conscious mind might think that you're looking at art or having a conversation or learning something, but you're actually not. These are like weird, very adjacent, but not entirely real experiences that like on some level deep inside of you, you will feel that hollowness, and it will actually like reduce the quality of your life in a way that you can't quantify or put your finger on, but it's going to be there.
Yeah. I mean, the like social media is also sort of like an MMORPG, yeah, or just like net communities in general, where instead of having to deal with like your normie neighbors or coworkers or whatever, you can just find your web community, and like this is a large way society has restructured over the last 30 years. Yeah. But then AI adds this, another element to it, where like you don't even have to listen to the morons in your Discord. You can AI can maybe tell you the higher truth if you believe it. I think most people don't believe in it that way, but I think increasingly everyone does interact with AI on some level of that spectrum, and it's just kind of like up to them if they can pass the Dunning-Kruger test and like figure out that, oh, this thing is just telling me what I want to hear.
Yeah.
It's lying to me all the time, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Although I will say, I mean, I get what your point, but I do have to say, I think this is a case where like we're going to get nostalgic for things that we used to think were shitty. And social media, I think, is one of those where like, you know, I like interacting with real people. Big shout out to my group chat, West Ham. I think that that's actually like, if you're doing it right, it's productive and it's human and you actually are connecting with people. But AI, there's nothing there. Right. There is no redemptive model. There's not like good and bad. It's just all bad.
Yeah, but I've seen, you know, even smart people form kind of loving relationships with their AI chatbot, and
that seems really dark to me.
The
whole thing seems really dark. Like, to get what you were saying, David, to go back to like purposeful communities and online communities, there was a shout out if anybody remembers this, but there was a bulletin board called punkrock.net. And I remember in the year, I think it was the year 2000. In the year 2000, I found an apartment through punkrock.net with another user of this bulletin board.
What was their screen name?
His screen name?
Yeah.
Well, shout out to Zev. Zev's his real name. I'm not sure what his screen name was at that point. But the point is like, there was a way in which it bled into real life. Like, I found an actual apartment, and it was like an actually good apartment, you know. And this was the social media and the internet world that, you know, we were raised, that we came up on, you know. And this feels so, when I read your writing, and your writing is very compelling, and the information is really compelling too, my eyes tend to gloss over, not because of the form and not even because of what you're expressing, but because this world that you're describing of these people in Silicon Valley, SBF and all these others, is so radically different from the world as I perceive it and understand it, that it's almost like crazy inducing to imagine people believing these things. Like, it's so far afield that I feel like an anthropologist studying some like quote unquote primitive people, you know, which I think I alluded to in the very beginning. But I think you're right that, like, we're going to look back on the 2000s. We're going to look back on even Web 2.0 mm-hmm. with a nostalgia, because this force, it feels like, is coming to destroy, I think, even the things that we were looking down upon 20 or 30 years ago. Yeah.
Well, and this is where I will say I am on this subject something of an accelerationist in the, like, original sense, which is that I think that AI and AI content specifically is actually going to, like, nuke a lot of these platforms and, like, Google search and a lot of these things to such a thorough degree that it pushes thoughtful people back off the internet entirely, or like really substantially. So, I mean, one actually kind of interesting and like sort of good for me example is that there is actually this kind of renaissance in newsletters, in like old school style blogs, basically. Mm-hmm. And people who want to read are actually like reading. And I think that the sort of inshittification, a term that I actually really admire, I'm forgetting who coined that, but I guess Cory Doctorow. Mm-hmm. But like that's, I think, has some salutary effects in some sense of like, you know, this is so bad, it's now entirely useless.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Like, people ask me sometimes, like, where are good sources for news? And I send them a bunch of Substacks, you know. I don't, like, I'll send them Dropsite or, like, Hellgate for New York. You know, there's, like, a few decent actual outlets out there. But, yeah, it's, like, who's better than Ken Klippenstein, you know? Yeah. And he's, he has Substack. That's it.
Yeah, and, you know, I was in sort of the conventional media world for, I guess, kind of like the last gasp. I really did very consciously like a like hid my true power level for 7 or 8 years while I was working for Fortune, and you know, very like conventional financial journalism. You know, Fortune in particular is like a little bit of a like CEO glow up shop. Like, they really just love to like feature CEOs, but they're also like a serious financial publication. And, you know, one of the things that I think is true about journalism and has been for a long time and still is to a degree is that like the only press you can actually trust is the business press, as long as you sort of know how
FT.
To get like, I mean, FT, Economist, even the Journal, frankly, to a significant degree. You know, if there's actual money on the line, you're motivated to tell the truth. That, I think, there is still that lingering vestige of real functional like press, but that's kind of it, you know, like the media is just done.
Yeah, here's a little class war tip. If you live in New York, go walk around the rich areas of Manhattan, like Gramercy Park, and you know, look for that pink newspaper and steal it right off the stoop. That's a little class war for
you. Oh, true.
Because the FT subscription is very expensive.
Yeah. I paid for it for a couple months recently by accident, and I really hate it.
I've been paying it for years. I'm like the kind of exact kind of sucker who's like,
I got to get your login.
Yeah, you should. I'd be happy to give it to you. Like, I'm too lazy to walk around Gramercy Park, and like, I'm too lazy to pirate it from something or like go to archive and try to get around the paywall.
Getting on the subway at 7 a.m. on a Sunday to go steal the FT.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I will say, if you, I hope you guys are doing the whole tax dodge, because you can, you know, write that off, get that 30% discount. So where should we pick back up on the actual, like, rationalists? What we haven't really talked. I guess I probably got sidetracked and talked too much about Ziz, but
yeah, I mean, there's so much to talk about Ziz. You know, there was the murders and the, you know, recent court appearances and stuff, and you've been following this really well. But there's also a really great True and On episode about it recently, so yes, people can check that out. But I guess, you know, your real area of expertise is SBF, and he is in prison now, I believe. Yep. But he's, despite being in prison, he's made a little bit of a comeback. He's like trying to rehabilitate himself. Not as a Democrat, like branding himself very effectively a few years ago, but now he's trying to be like a Tucker guy.
Yeah.
How is that going for him?
This is the most hilarious part of this whole story, and I think really illustrates how this like rationalist utilitarian mindset actually winds up producing bad results just literally on its own terms even. So to rewind a little bit, back in, you know, 2020, 2021, when he was first really starting to become a big public figure, Sam Bankman-Fried made waves in part by promising to donate $1 billion to Democratic politics, which was, again, a highly regarded thing to say in the first place and not, you know, realistic, even if everything had been above board. But it turns out, you know, he was, a lot of the donations that he was making to, let's say, Biden and other Democratic candidates was money that he had stolen from his customers. So along with all of the other expenditures that were coming out of FTX for, like, stadium naming rights and paying $500 million to meet Katy Perry and all of this other really ridiculous stuff. So he was stealing money to make all these donations so that he could get influence in Washington towards this grander scheme of his, which was ultimately to become both a financial titan and a political influencer. And this sense of, like, I can predict the future, so I'm just going to borrow a little bit of money from my customers, make these plays, FTX is going to be huge, I'll pay back the money I borrowed, and everything's going to be fine. The political donations were part of that strategy, except, in addition to donating all this money to Democrats, he was also using his executives as straw donors to funnel stolen money to Republicans as well at the same time. But he was doing it clandestinely, basically. And, you know, his mother, Barbara Fried, actually advised on how to conceal the source of these funds. Unfortunately, there was never a trial on the campaign finance charges for complicated reasons having to do with his extradition from the Bahamas. So his parents' role in the crimes was actually quite thoroughly squashed because there wasn't the second trial that was planned. But the upshot is that he was basically doing campaign finance fraud so that he could pose as a Democratic mega donor, which is all Donald Trump remembers, because Donald Trump doesn't remember anything but headlines, right? So Bankman-Fried fucked himself in an incredibly satisfying way.
But didn't Altman kind of, wasn't he also kind of lib-coded and now, but he won over Trump?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that story in as much detail, but I would say it's more in the main line of like, oh, I was wrong, I'm just going to flip a little bit here.
Yeah.
Whereas like Bankman-Fried actually like went out of his way to like pretend to be the one thing that is making sure he's not getting that pardon, you know, because that's all Donald Trump remembers is like Sam Bankman-Fried, oh, he like really helped Biden and I hate Biden.
But his narrative now, SBF's narrative, is like, this was all part of my brilliant plan. Like, the, you know, the Democrats will lock me up, but then I'll reveal I was actually a Republican all along and you'll let me out and help, and I can help you.
That was part of his, like, he actually wrote, after the collapse, he wrote himself a document of like a bunch of ideas for how to spin his narrative. And that was one of them, which was, I think it was literally like, come out against the woke agenda, go on Tucker. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's like, I think it's an illustration that he's like not actually a very smart guy. It's like this very simple-minded play. And of course, like, the other funny part is that when he went on Tucker, it was like without permission from the jail. He just like used the like family calling system to do this interview.
That's and then pretty badass.
He immediately got thrown in solitary confinement.
Whoa.
And actually got put on a bus to go to the federal prison that he had resisted going to, because, you know, this guy is like fairly delusional. And for the year plus since he was first thrown in jail and since his conviction, he's actually remained at the MDC in Brooklyn, where he has had like Puffy as a like cohabitant.
And Ghislaine and Luigi.
Oh, I didn't realize those. Yeah, so he like stayed there because he like wanted to work on his appeal, and which is like another pipe dream of his. But because he did this Tucker thing, he got thrown in a bus and sent to California, where he's like, this is another weird part of this sort of subtext, is like he doesn't want to be in California where his parents are. And I don't know like exactly why that is, but I think it speaks to, you know, he does have, while I would not give him the credit of, I mean, okay, one of the theories of the book is that he's not an autist. He's not autistic. He's the opposite, which is he's a sociopath, which is he like knows all too well how to tell people what they want to hear, at least sometimes. He doesn't get it right all the time. But I think that he also just like he lacks that emotional connection.
Wow, just like
again.
AI. That's amazing.
I think I read somewhere in your Substack you were quoting him as saying, I don't have a soul. Like, I don't feel things the way other people feel things. So he himself recognized there's something wrong with him, right?
Yeah, he's at least, like, talked about that. And he's also talked very explicitly about, I had to practice smiling. I had to practice having, like, natural facial reactions. And the other, you know, and I'm not a doctor, and this is not a diagnosis, but he displays these behaviors. The other very sociopathic tendency that he displays is that he is shown zero remorse, and not only that, but like genuinely does not seem to understand why other people think he did anything wrong, and he has these like elite defenders around him, including you know, Michael Lewis's book that is basically in his on his side, just echoing his lines that once you really think about the financial aspects of it, they don't make any sense. I mean, it's like very clear he's constantly talking about like, oh, we made these investments and they did great and everything's fine and we had the money. But like he's confessing to a crime while he's saying that, because, you know, the exchange was not supposed to be investing customer funds. That's the entire thing. And so he just like seems to have this like missing link in his thinking about what he did, where he's like, no, I just took the money and I did things with it and it's fine. And he just keeps coming back to that view of his own case, which is, I mean, on the one hand, like crazy making, because it's just like, oh, he's just saying the same thing again and again and again. It does not process reality. But on the other hand, it's like, is he still a fly guy clapping if nobody ain't hear it? And can they
testify from in the spirit? Hey, folks, Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall. Slip like 40 in your first and last step to playing yourself like accordion. When he at the mic, you don't go next. Leaving pussy cats like why hoes need Kotex. Exercise index won't need Bowflex and won't take the one with no skinny legs like Joe Tex.